This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being here with us on a chilly but pretty Sunday morning here at WNRN 91.9 and Harrisonburg's 95.1. Our topic today, one that should get everybody tuned in and fired up, because it's the Affordable Care Act, because health insurance is important to everyone, also known as Obamacare. With our expert, our resident expert, our repeat expert, thank you for returning, Carolyn Engelhard. She's the director of the Health Policy Program and the Department of Public Health Sciences at UVA's Med School. Thanks for coming back, Carolyn.
Sure. Hi, everybody. Great to be back with you.
Thank you. It's a tough topic. We were talking about that just a moment ago. something that affects everyone. And something that everyone has their own experience with. Tough to sort of talk about it in the abstract manner.
Right. Well, as you mentioned, Rick, health insurance really is important. And how people get their health care is a very personal and yet societal issue. And the ACA, or Obamacare, has just finished its first year. Maybe your listeners would enjoy or appreciate hearing sort of a one-year recap of what's happening. So Obamacare, the ACA, was passed in March 2010. A few of the components rolled out pretty soon after that, like young adults being able to stay on their parents' plans and some of the pre-existing condition clauses that were eliminated for kids and things like that. But the majority of the benefits, if you want to call it that, rolled out January 1, 2014, just a little bit more than a year ago, after a very, very difficult rollout with a dysfunctional website. But then eventually it sort of picked up. The administration threw lots and lots of money at it, which was pretty controversial. And at the end of the day, almost 7 million people purchased health plans on the websites, both the federal and the state websites. Most Americans went to the federal website to get health insurance plans, those that went. And the Medicaid expansion program, which is also very controversial and we can talk more about, or maybe your listeners will have some questions about, because Virginia is one of the states that has opted not to have the Medicaid expansion. But at the end of the day, 1 year out, 23 million Americans received health insurance through the ACA. 10 million Americans were previously uninsured that got it. And we're starting now for year two. So that's the way I'd like to just open it up, and then back to you.
That doesn't seem like a large number. I mean, I guess, you know, 10 million people, that's the, if you want to put them all in on a football field, put them all in a state, that's a large number. But as far as a percentage of Americans go, that seems like an awfully small percentage. Am I being negative about that?
No, it's you're reflecting what many people have said, and that is, why did we need a huge social policy that cost $1 trillion over 10 years to really pick up 15% of the population that was without health insurance? Now, that's an overly simplistic answer, because many people before the ACA had health insurance, but it wasn't very good health insurance. And one of the things the ACA did is require everyone to have health insurance that had certain levels of benefits. That also made the insurance more expensive for some people. And that, again, was problematic both for the administration and for some Americans, and has caused some of the you know, lack of support for the plan. But you're right, 10 million people, What I should say, though, is that before the ACA went into effect, there were about 40 million people without health insurance in this country. And as of the last count, at the end of year one, we had reduced that by about 10 million or 25%. So if you look at it that way, it's since the uninsured numbers in this country have rarely dipped below 35, 36 million, in that sense, we sort of shook up and made a difference in how many people actually had health insurance.
And I don't mean to state that. We'll get into my personal beliefs on this a little while later. I guess that's not the important part of the program as far as those who are insured and uninsured. But Carolyn Engelhard here, she's director of the health policy program at UVA's School of Medicine. Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. By the way, is Obamacare still the negative slang for Affordable Care Act that it originally was?
I don't think so. I think it's kind of a shortened way of identifying it. The administration's embraced it. If you go to the website for the ACA, they call it Obamacare. People write about it, calling that. There's still confusion in Americans. There was that famous, I don't remember what talk show it was on, where someone...
I think it was Jay Leno or Jimmy Fallon. Where
exactly,
they
one
went
of
down
those.
The street and asked if you supported Affordable Care Act and you would get yes, and if you supported Obamacare and people would say no.
Right, exactly. And the president's approval rating is not very good right now. That's not unusual for a president in their second term going into the last 2 years. One could say that the midterm elections, where Republicans took both control of the Senate and the House, was a reflection of the country's disapproval of Obama. I think people tend to gravitate towards what they don't like about something rather than what they do like about it. But I think Obamacare has just become now a shortened way of referring to the ACA because, you know, the Affordable Care Act just doesn't really tell you what you're talking about. And especially if you use the whole acronym, which is the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, PPACA. Now, what in the world does that mean? Whereas if you go to Canada, you know, their national health system is called Medicare. Now, we have obviously Medicare for people over the age of 65 in this country, but people kind of know what that means. But if you say the ACA, people kind of look at you funny, like, I have no clue what you're talking about. So Obamacare is just our shorthand way of referring to it. And while some still use the term negatively, I think others just sort of use it to refer to it.
All right. So, Obamacare, when this was originally put forth by President Obama, it seems to me that it had two goals. And correct me when I'm bound to be wrong. One was to get more Americans to have health insurance. The other was to lower the overall cost of health insurance for each American. And so has this been accomplished in an overall manner? And then let's dig a little deeper on each one.
So with the first one, has it expanded coverage? The answer is yes. As I mentioned before, 10 million people now have insurance that didn't have it before Obamacare. The second question is it more affordable? The answer is, well, it depends. It depends on who you are. I'm on the board of the Free Clinic here in Charlottesville, and some of our patients, all of our patients are uninsured, and many of them are eligible for subsidies on the marketplaces of the ACA, Obamacare. And because many of our patients are fairly poor, they can get low-cost health insurance on the exchanges, on the marketplaces. We can talk about the high deductibles that go along with that and whether that makes it affordable, but access to health insurance for people who could not afford it in the past has happened. 85% of everyone who came to the marketplaces to get insurance, to buy a health insurance plan with a subsidy, 85% received a sizable subsidy in order to buy a plan. So it has become more affordable for them. For people who are not under 400% of the federal poverty level, which is about $46,000 for an individual, those folks who are either uninsured or who had a bare-bones health insurance policy that was cheap, and they could no longer keep those because it didn't qualify under the ACA as a good enough health care plan, they are now paying more for their plans. And so they would say to you, hell no, it's not more affordable. I'm paying a lot more than I paid last year, and I'm having to pay for things I'll never use, like maternity coverage.
And so it seems like the answer to part two is no as an overall statement, because if 85% have healthcare is less expensive, the 15% who are using the healthcare exchange, that's a significant number of Americans who are using the exchanges because they otherwise cannot afford health insurance, correct?
Absolutely.
So we're talking about millions of people whose health insurance costs have gone up.
Well, we're talking about, let's break this down. 160 million Americans, it's over 50% of us, get health insurance where we work. The Affordable Care Act, for most Americans who get their insurance where they work, made no difference. If you were in a small business and the business offered a crummy health insurance plan, then small businesses over 50 employees starting this year, have to have better plans. But for most Americans that work for fairly large companies, their lives didn't change at all. The people who really stood to benefit from the ACA and who the ACA was really targeted for were those individuals who did not have health insurance at their jobs and the individual market in health insurance wasn't working for them, either because they had a pre-existing condition, because they were older, or because they just couldn't afford it. And so those folks have gone to the exchanges, the marketplaces, and 85% of them have received a pretty hefty subsidy to help buy health insurance.
All right, so let's pause for a second. Again, our guest today, Carolyn Engelhardt, she is from UVA's School of Medicine. We're talking about Obamacare. And Carolyn's here because in 2015, things are ramping up with Obamacare, correct?
Yes.
So Carolyn was a guest about, 15, 16 months ago as Obamacare was starting. There was all the news about what was going to happen, how you had to sign up. There were both sides of Obamacare on how it was going to save America and how it was going to ruin America. And Carolyn was here with honest answers to everyone's questions, which we'll do again today. You're welcome to call up with your question, 434-979-0919, for your question about Obamacare. But when we talk about the changes in Obamacare, we talk about the health insurance exchanges, and I see the phone starts ringing right away. Here's the phone number. Call up with your question for Obamacare. Why is it that explain to me the health insurance exchange because that's one of the first things we start tossing this out there, because I've read the articles and doing my homework. You're, as you said earlier, you're deep in the weeds on knowing what all this information is. If I'm trying to identify whether or not I qualify or don't qualify, whether my state is part of the exchange or I need to go to the federal exchange, explain to me in simple 101 terms the exchange and what it offers differently from what my employer, my cheap employer, may offer me.
Well, first of all, if you work for an employer that offers health insurance, and that health insurance offers, I don't want to get too in the weeds, but there's a certain level that it has to offer, 60% actuarial, but I don't want to lose people. If your employer offers that level of health insurance, you may not go to the exchange and get a subsidy. You're not allowed to. The exchange is really for people who do not have access to employer-based health insurance. So how does the exchange...
Well, if I work for Walmart, mm-hmm. not to pick on companies, I can go to the exchange. Because I'm not going to be offered, I'm not going to get enough hours to be offered insurance.
Correct. If you work at Walmart and you're not eligible for their health insurance plan, then you can go to the exchange. And probably if you work at Walmart, you're not getting paid all that much. And you would be eligible for a subsidy. And what you would do is, if you were in one of the 37 states that goes to the federal government for their exchange, you would go to healthcare.gov, and they have a bunch of questions they ask you, and then you would start filling out the application. And they would determine, based on your own self-disclosed income, what kind of subsidy, how much subsidy you would receive. And then, depending on your zip code, you would be shown which health plans are available in your geographic area and how much they cost and how much of a subsidy you would receive and then how much you would have to pay out of pocket.
Okay, but not everybody works for Walmart. And there are plenty of small businesses who have been offering health insurance. And one of them, apparently, is John. John, hang on a second. Oh, darn it. John, I did that the wrong way. Sorry. John, call back. Sorry, Melissa. And John, hopefully, will call right back. 434-979-0919. John's going to call back. He's a small business owner. And I'll let him ring up and talk about that. But there's a difference between what the small business owner needs to do, correct?
If you have 50 employees or less, you are not required to offer health insurance under Obamacare. If you have more than 50 full-time employees, full-time employee is defined as 30 hours or more a week, then you are required to offer health insurance. For the small business with 50 to 100 employees, that begins in 2016. For the companies with over 100 employees, that begins this year, 2015.
All right. So let's, John, I'm sorry. I did that in backwards step motion. Are you with us?
Sure am, Rick. How are you? Good morning.
I'm well. Thanks for calling in. All right. So, John, you're a small business owner. So what? Give us your number of employees and how Obamacare is affecting you and your decision-making process.
Well, we have 4 employees here in the U.S., and we've always paid our medical and dental 100% for our employees, myself included. And I was definitely for Obamacare, no doubt about it. I think it's important that all of us have access to good medical coverage. But what I was shocked to see, you know, I've always been, quote-unquote, a good employer. We've taken care of our folks. But my premiums went up 70%. We're a healthy group. We don't have many claims, and my healthcare professionals, where we buy our insurance, it was strictly because of Obamacare. And the shocking thing for me, Rick, is in everything I read, everything I listened to, I was engaged in this process. No one had ever mentioned this.
Yeah. Hi, John.
John, hang on the line, by the way, while Carolyn talks about this.
I don't exactly know what your situation is. And first of all, I want to thank you for being a conscientious employer. There are lots of employers that don't have very many employees that don't offer health insurance because they feel they can't afford it. So I want to applaud you for trying to do the right thing and be part of the system. I don't know exactly why your premiums went up 70%. I can speculate it might be because the health plan that you offered in the past didn't have all the essential benefits that are required under the ACA. Now, I'm not saying that the essential benefit program required under the ACA is the right mix. It might be too generous, but it's what the Institute of Medicine decided, and the government took their advice as to what should be included in a comprehensive health plan. It's either because your price increase may have been because you needed to offer more categories of benefits that you weren't offering in the past. There are some additional fees under Obamacare that some employers have to pay. And, you know, what happens is when you're in a group, a small group insurance market or a larger group insurance market, sometimes you end up paying, if you have a healthy group, you end up paying more because you're helping to subsidize a sicker group. The ACA, whether it's for individuals or companies, is a movement. And I'm not saying I agree with this or not, but it is a movement towards social insurance, much like we think of Social Security or Medicare, where we're all put into a big pool and the healthy subsidize the sick, the young subsidize the old. That's why they call it social insurance. And there will be winners and there will be some losers. And I am sorry that in your case, you obviously things have not worked out the way you had hoped.
John, you have a reply?
And thank you very much for that, for your comments. This has happened to most of my business colleagues around the country. As I've talked to people, I say, how did this affect you? None of my colleagues experienced an increase of under 50%. These are people with big companies, people with small companies, entrepreneurs like myself. And I frankly think, and look, I'm a politically liberal person, although maybe fiscally, I guess I'm more Republican in that way, but there was no mention of it. And the reaction that I've gotten from my colleagues is everybody was a bit blindsided by this. Had my insurance underwriter said to us last year when we first started investigating this, hey, just be prepared for a pretty hefty premium increase, I think this was purposely not publicized. It's the only thing that my president has done that makes me, frankly, ashamed. No one should be surprised by the cost they pay for health care. All of this should have been vetted, should have been publicly made transparent. And it's really just, I'm kind of disappointed in this process. We have the money to pay it. We do it cheerfully. I'm for this initiative, but there was not full disclosure.
Hey, John, can I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
Because one of the things from, I guess, from some of my more liberal friends is that the insurance companies have taken advantage of this situation and have, when you have a representative who says, be on the lookout for a rise in premiums, and then they raise the premiums.
Well, so, you know, Rick, we're the only civilized nation in the world that has a for-profit healthcare system.
Oh, I understand that completely.
And to give you an idea, I have all of my medical work, my checkups done at Bumrungrad Hospital in Bangkok. where for under $1,000, I can get a comprehensive executive checkup that would cost $15,000 at Martha Jeffrey UVA. And I'm fortunate that I'm able to do that because I travel for my company. But if we took the profit out of healthcare in this country, we'd be able to return those monies back into the economy. So the problem really lies in the fact that we've got a for-profit healthcare system.
Well, John, I obviously you know you've done your homework and you've seen this both from within the industry as well as outside. And I wish most Americans would be able to have that perspective as you, because clearly you feel hurt. You feel that it was sort of a bait and switch on the part of the president. I won't defend that. I will only say that we are in a geographic area. What we've learned from Obamacare, the ACA, is if you're in a more urban area and there's more competition within the health insurance companies, the premiums tend to be lower. So we here in Charlottesville and Central Virginia don't have the same level of choice as someone would in the D.C. area. But even so, I hear what you're saying. And as far as the for-profit insurance sector goes, you know, I do a lot of talks on the ACA, and I teach health policy at UVA, and my course at UVA is an overview of the whole U.S. healthcare system. It's not just about Obamacare. And many people don't understand, as you do, that they think that the choice is either a for-profit, sort of capitalistic insurance industry or socialized medicine. And there are lots of options in between those two things. Germany is a good example of, and Switzerland as well, where insurance companies are all not-for-profit, they're regulated, and so they don't have that for-profit mentality. That's something we could look at in the United States, but most Americans don't trust government regulation. They prefer the free market, even if, as you just noted, in the insurance industry, even if the free market and for-profit companies end up, you know, sort of gouging us sometimes.
Hey, well, John, thanks so much. I need to let the phone lines open up to others.
No worries. Thanks, guys, very much.
Bye, right. John. Thanks for your question.
Okay. All right, 11:27. I can't believe that 27 minutes already have gone by. That was a great call from John. Thank you so much. 11:27 here on the Wake Up Call with Carolyn Englehart. Let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Support for WNRN comes from the Charlottesville Realtors of Montague Miller & Company, plus
Sedona Tap House, serious food, and over 500 craft beers at 1035 Millmont Street, Charlottesville, behind Barracks Road Shopping Center. Sedona Tap House hosts Seafood Sunday with fresh, hand-cut, wood-grilled fish on special, plus a craft beer seminar and tasting at 1 p.m. 434-296-BEER or SedonaTapHouse.com. You can also find Sedona Tap House in Westchester Commons, Midlothian.
T&N Printing, serving Virginia since 1982. In addition to printing and copying, T&N specializes in construction document management, as well as dry mounting, binding, and mail services. T&N offers FSC-certified printing. T&N Printing can be reached at T-NPrinting.com.
Old Hill Cider at Showalter's Orchard in Timberville, whose tasting room is open year-round, serving Old Hill's six styles of hard cider by the glass or the flight, with a style of cider for every palate. You can learn where to find Old Hill Cider's Betwixt and Cider Maker's Barrel at OldHillCider.com.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in today. This is WNRN Community Independent Radio. This is Rick Moore. My guest today, Carolyn Englehart, Director, Health Policy Program, UVA's Virginia School of Medicine. Carolyn, thank you so much for being here. That was a great phone call.
Yes,
from John.
It was.
We are talking about Obamacare, all kinds of topics. I wasn't sure. I mean, there's so much doing your homework. I don't know how you do this, because just trying to gather my thoughts on this topic. It is one of the most difficult topics that I have done in the year, and just trying to put it all together in your brain and find any sort of linear thought process, which I've obviously been unable to do. 434-979-0919. I promise I'll do my best to not hang up on you too. 434-979-0919. And there goes the phone. Let's do our best while the phone call comes in, Carolyn. There's an upcoming Supreme Court case to talk about whether or not Obamacare remains legally allowed. King versus Burwell.
Right.
What's the expectation?
Wow. So, you know, the ACA, Obamacare, has had several near-death experiences, and this is the latest. The first one, if you and anyone out there is interested in this, I'll run through them very quickly. The first one had to do with when Teddy Kennedy died and they appointed his replacement in the Senate, and then the House and the Senate passed their versions of the ACA. This was in 2009. And then they had a special election in early 2010. And for the first time in 35 years, a Republican went into the Senate from Massachusetts. And that then gave the Senate one too few votes to overcome a filibuster. That was the first near-death experience. It survived that. The second near-death experience was the Supreme Court challenge the first time around. It survived that in 2012. And then when Obama was reelected, that was sort of the third near-death experience. So this is the fourth near-death experience for the ACA, and we'll have to ask whether it's like a cat and has nine lives. But basically, this was a sleeper issue. Most lawyers, most legal experts that I know, thought this would never have any legs. That's a term meaning, you know, viability. And yet it does. And basically, there is a statement in the ACA. Now, the ACA is a 2,000-page bill, but there is a statement, it's like seven words in it, that says that the tax credits, these are the subsidies you get to go on to the exchange to get health insurance, the tax credits are available only to Americans who enrolled, quote, through an exchange established by the state, unquote. Now, other places in the law, it talks about the federal exchange being there in states that do not set up their own exchange. It talks about the federal government acting on behalf of the states and all of that. But that expression led conservative opponents of Obamacare to question the constitutionality of the law, saying that according to that literal translation of the statute, only states could offer tax credits. Now, as I mentioned earlier in the show, 37 states go to the federal government's exchange, which means, of course, a very, you know, many, many fewer have their own state-based exchanges. If this were to pass, if the Supreme Court took this up, surprisingly, before it exhausted itself at the appellate level, which is very unusual for a Supreme Court to do that. So either the Supreme Court had ideas about it, or they said, look, it's just a matter of time till it comes before us. We're going to go ahead and put it on our docket for the next year. So the Supreme Court will look at this and decide whether or not tax credits or subsidies are eligible for those folks who buy health insurance on the federal exchange. Last year, that was 5 million people. So if the Supreme Court would find in favor of the plaintiffs, those are the conservatives who brought the suit, then potentially 5 million people who had received tax credits last year to buy insurance would no longer be eligible for those subsidies and probably would not be able to afford health insurance on the exchanges.
Do you think that, so let's say that the Supreme Court accepts this technicality and says, okay, so by the way, the IRS, you can't offer, you can't give them a tax break if they bought the, went through the health insurance, the federal exchange. Do you think that there's enough people in those states to have some sort of tidal wave to a difference in those, would you say, 37 states and say, hey, come on now, we're going to start voting people out. We're going to start doing something about this.
Well, in Virginia, there were almost 300,000 people that bought it on the exchange. Now, can 300,000 people dictate an election in Virginia? I don't know. I guess it depends on who those 300,000 are. But I, just as Obama got cremated for saying you can keep your insurance if you like it, and then people couldn't, and that became, you know, a big, big deal, I can also imagine in the, I can also imagine the Democrats taking, the Republicans are going to take away your health insurance. The Republicans took away your health insurance, also getting some political traction. And I mean, and even if we just stay away from the cynical view of politics, the folks, those 5 million people who had health insurance would lose that. And that would raise, I mean, I talked earlier about a net decrease of the number of the uninsured of 10 million in 1 year. That could potentially wipe that out, and half of that in one fell swoop.
11:36, we're talking about Obamacare. An update on everything that's happening in 2015 and has happened since Carolyn Engelhardt's last visit. We have a caller. We have Keith. Hi, Keith.
Good morning. Enjoying the topic here. I had a question. I was wondering if your guest and yourself could maybe talk about some of the inputs for the risk pools. My sense is, and as I talk to friends and that there's some inequitable things happening, especially for those that maybe do take care of themselves and are burdened twofold. One, with the increased premiums because they have to defray the costs. As the guest said, there are winners and losers in this scenario. But I wonder if you could speak generally and give perspective about these risk pools and how, if any, there are incentives, especially for those maybe lower socioeconomic that haven't had access to health care and now they're getting it, and whether somehow that can be neutralized for those, you know, across the pool, or whether there's more commingling of different risk groups, et cetera. Sorry, I'm trying to keep it succinct, but hopefully that's...
All right, Keith, thanks for the call.
So, Keith, that's a really, really good question, and it has lots of layers to it. So let's just start with risk pool. Maybe some of the listeners out there don't understand what you're talking about. So every insurance product depends on a risk pool. If you have automobile insurance or homeowners insurance, you pay your insurance premium and you're put into a pool. And I tell my students, insurance is the one service or commodity where they don't want you to use their product. So if you make shoes, people want you to buy shoes. If you make widgets, people want you to buy widgets. But when you buy insurance, the best outcome for your premium down the road is if you never use your insurance. My homeowner's insurance, I have zero claims, went up 30% 1 year. And when I asked why, my insurance company said, well, because there were all the floods and hurricanes and things like that nationally. My risk pool had experienced higher than average risk, and everyone in the pool helped pay for that risk. That's the definition of a risk pool. And from an insurance perspective, what you want to do is get tons of people into this pool and only a few people use the services, and they statistically sort of become outliers and they fall off, and hopefully the premium remains stable. That's the way risk pools work. In health insurance, if you have too many sick people in your risk pool, you are going to have escalating premiums it's, in insurance terms, can become what's called a death spiral, which means it will just implode. Or you'll have something called adverse selection, which is only people buy insurance who know they're going to use it. That's why under the ACA, the individual mandate, which was very unpopular, it remains unpopular, was necessary, because we had to get, we meaning the country, had to get everybody into the risk pool, healthy people as well as sick, in order to moderate the pool so that not only sick people were in it. By doing that, it, as I mentioned earlier, meant that some of the healthier people, the lower risk people, perhaps like you, who take care of yourself and maybe don't have a chronic condition or don't use a lot of health care, end up subsidizing those who are sicker. That's the nature of social insurance, and why the ACA has moved us from, is trying to move us, for good or bad, from pockets of what are called risk-based insurance or actuarial insurance, where your group pays a premium based on your experience. So if you have a small group of really healthy 28-year-olds, say you're a biotech firm, and you don't have many health bills, you're going to have a really great rate. If you're only employing 60-year-old employees, you're probably going to have a much worse. What the ACA is trying to do is to blend all of those things together at some level, so that people who are older, who used to pay 7 times more than the younger, are now restricted to only paying 3 times as more than the younger. And the younger end up paying more because that's what happens with the assumption is they will get older and they will benefit as they age, but they may not benefit right now. It's a philosophical issue, it's a political issue, and it's also an insurance issue.
But Keith also asks about preventative care. And for much of the lifetime that I can remember, is that preventative care has been, you've been deterred from preventative care because it has cost, I don't get to pay my $25 copay to go see the doctor because I want an annual checkup. I have to have an actual illness. I have to feel bad to go see my doctor. And so what does Obamacare say about preventative medicine?
Well, actually, it says quite a lot. Every qualified health plan under the ACA, both on the exchanges and outside the exchanges, have to offer certain preventive services without any cost sharing. And that includes screenings, so mammograms for women, flu shots, colonoscopies over the age of 50, an annual visit. Those things now have to be offered in these health plans without a copay. The idea is that you get in there, you find a festering problem before it becomes acute, and you...
Festering problem.
Well, that's... You know, that you're able to identify problems when they're small as opposed to when they get acute and you go to the ED and you're much sicker than you would be. Let me just say to your listeners, though, and this is going to sound sacrilegious, so please don't throw vegetables at me just yet, everybody, but preventive care doesn't pay for itself. The heart attack that you discourage at age 50 because you're on a statin will leave a much sicker 80-year-old dying of prostate cancer or another kind of cancer. Doesn't mean we shouldn't do preventive care. We absolutely should. It increases productivity in your job. It makes higher quality of life, but it won't save society a lot of money. The only preventive services that have been known to really pay for themselves are childhood vaccines and smoking cessation. So I'll just put that out there as a little health policy 101 lesson.
434-979-0919. That's 979-0919. Carolyn Engelhard here, director of the health policy program at UVA's med school. talking about Obamacare.
Today's programming on WNRN is supported by
Crozet Pizza at the Buddhist Biker Bar, two Virginia traditions on the UVA corner. It's Crozet's iconic pizza for carryout or dine-in with parking on Elliewood Avenue. There's live music at Crozet Pizza plus live DJs every Thursday. You can find the original Crozet Pizza in Crozet with expanded dining room.
The Valentine, celebrating the completion of a multi-million dollar renovation with This is Richmond, Virginia, a new exhibition featuring the diverse stories that tell the history of this important region. Information at thevalentine.org. The Valentine, collecting and interpreting Richmond, Virginia's stories for more than a century.
Specialty Beverage of Virginia, distributors of the Green Flash Brewery, whose East Coast brewery opens this year, bringing their award-winning hoppy favorites, including the West Coast Double IPA, Palate Wrecker Triple IPA, Soul Style IPA, and Jibe Session IPA. Green Flash Brewery can be found wherever world-class beer is sold.
Hello, I'm Bob from Blue Ridge Scottish Country Dancers. Every Tuesday, we present our Scottish Country Dancing class at St. Paul's Ivy Parish Hall in Ivy at 6:30 p.m. No experience is necessary. You also are invited to our dance on January 18th. This event will begin at 2 in the afternoon, also at St. Paul's Ivy Parish Hall. You can enjoy live music featuring Mike Dunn on the fiddle and Janet Muse on piano. There will be a potluck dinner, haggis, bagpipes, drums, Kaylee dancing, Scottish Country Dancing, and whiskey tasting. For more information on Blue Ridge Scottish Country Dancers, you can visit us online, mhscdc.webs.com. I'm Bob, making a community connection on WNRN.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection at WNRN.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you very much for listening to us today talk about Obamacare with Carolyn Engelhard from UVA's School of Medicine. 434-979-0919. If you want to call up, ask a question, that's 979-0919 for Carolyn Engelhard. Carolyn, we talked in and out about state health exchanges versus the federal health exchange. Many people in our listening area know that state of Virginia has decided not to start their own health exchange. I want to learn more about, talk about that on a non-political basis. What are the pros and cons about making that choice?
Sure. So right now, only 13 states, but plus the District of Columbia, run their own state exchanges. Those states that do tend to be more liberal, tend to have Democratic governors or state houses, and are more sympathetic to the ACA. It's in order to understand why states do or do not have them, or did or did not establish them, you kind of have to go back to politics, because the states were required to disclose whether or not they were going to set up an exchange by December of 2012. Now, if you remember, a month before that was the presidential election, November of 2012, and many states with Republican governors or Republican legislators had hoped that Mitt Romney would be elected and that maybe the Senate would ride his coattails and become Republican, and they would just get rid of Obamacare altogether, because that was one of the campaign promises. When Obama was reelected, states had only a month to decide if they were going to run their own exchanges. And for those who were on the fence, it probably wasn't enough time to put it into place. So some of it was a timing issue.
And like Virginia, they're not even in session at that time.
That's correct. Virginia's only in session mid-January to March, depending on whether it's a long or a short session, a six-week or an eight-week session. And it's understandable states did not want to have their own exchanges because it would require a huge infrastructure. They would need to hire more people. Insurance matters. States oversee health insurance regulation. And I think the administration and the people who wrote the ACA thought more states would want to run their own exchanges because, you know, insurance is local. Health insurance companies are local. They're statewide. But I think the hassle of trying to put in that infrastructure, hiring new people, working with the federal government, worrying that the dollars would be there was just, and hoping that the whole law would just go away is what kept most states from implementing their own state exchanges.
Is it or is it not? I understand the politics. If you are on one side, you don't agree with Obamacare, and if you're on the other side, you do. But if I read the information correctly, non-expansion states have turned down $424 billion in federal dollars to help pay. So it seems as though the federal government would give you more money than you would spend if you used your own state exchange. And what? You have to make jobs. I heard you say the word about you have to hire people. And we all want jobs, 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 jobs.
Right, right. So, Rick, I'm glad you brought that up because what you're talking about now is the Medicaid expansion, which is different than the exchanges. So the exchanges are where you go buy health insurance. The Medicaid expansion is expanding a public program, Medicaid, for different people, for more people. And that's the federal government. And okay, so now just let me go back just a tiny little bit. So I mentioned one of the near-death experiences for Obamacare was the first time it hit the Supreme Court. And when the first time it hit the Supreme Court, they ruled looking at, is the individual mandate constitutional and can the federal government force states to expand their Medicaid program? And the Supreme Court said, yes, the individual mandate is constitutional, and no, the federal government cannot force states to expand their Medicaid program. Why did the ACA include the Medicaid expansion? Traditional Medicaid program is what we call a categorical program and only covers certain categories of people: poor pregnant women, poor kids, and the frail elderly and the disabled. There are most of the uninsured in this country are folks that don't make a lot of money. They make too much. They don't fit into one of those Medicaid categories. They don't work for a job that gives health insurance. And they make, you know, maybe $20,000, $25,000 a year max. So they said, so the federal government under the ACA said, okay, let's offer Medicaid for these folks up to 138% of the federal poverty level, which is $16,000 for an individual per year, or $27,000 for, say, a mom with two kids or a dad with two kids. States could or could not do that expansion. Right now, 27 states are doing it because the federal government is paying 100% of those newly eligible folks for the first 3 years, and then it steps down to 90% after 7 years and stays at that rate forever. States are getting huge amounts of federal dollars to expand their Medicaid program, which means that people in their state have health insurance. Even conservative states like Arizona and New Jersey, Chris Christie, and Indiana, John Kasich, governors, Republican governors, I think there are 9 Republican governors now that have embraced the Medicaid expansion because it just is too hard to turn away that much federal money. And it means that their safety net hospitals in their states and other hospitals aren't taking care of the uninsured and having bad debt. So the states that have not expanded their Medicaid programs, like Virginia have some explaining to do. And if Delegate Bell were here right now, or other conservatives in our state legislature, they would say that, number one, Medicaid is not a good program, doesn't pay providers well, and it's it requires a lot of federal rules. And number two, that they don't trust the federal government to keep giving states that money. They're going to pull the rug out. And so, and number three, Obamacare is still is a very maligned among many conservatives. So for those reasons, the minority of states are not accepting the Medicaid expansion, and they are almost all conservative states.
11:55 in the wake up call. Just a few minutes left with Carolyn Engelhart as we talk about Obamacare. So here's a bunch of questions. So let's see how many we can get through.
Okay. I'll try to be more succinct.
you talk about, Medicaid not being a great program, or people are saying that it's not cost effective.
It is cost effective. It is cost effective. It just doesn't pay
well.
Right.
My poor choice. 50% of Medicaid providers could not offer appointments, has been claimed. So coverage is not always accessible.
Exactly. And that's really a problem. And it's going to be made more of a problem because under the ACA, those primary care physicians who took Medicaid patients were going to be paid a higher rate for the first 2 years to absorb these new enrollees. And that ended December 2014. So we're looking at a pay cut for those Medicaid providers. And so you're exactly right. That's one of the problems with this bill, is it unleashes a lot of new people into the system, but the physicians may not see them if they don't get paid.
Can a doctor just say, you know what, I don't want to be on that program?
Yes.
We know that the 2015 Congress is staunchly Republican. They want to repeal Obamacare in a variety of ways, including employee mandate of making you only available if you have full-time being 40 hours a week. They want to remove the individual mandate. What would be left of Obamacare if they do these things that they talk about?
It would be a much scaled back program. They can't, as long as Obama is the president, he will veto any absolute repeal legislation. But the Appropriations Committee in the House, where the money bills go, can trim back some of the dollars that fund that. For instance, they might decide to only provide tax subsidies, tax credits for people up to 300% of the federal poverty level, not 400%. Or they might, as you say, change the definition for what a full-time worker is. They can trim around the edges, which will take some money away, which will leave the law in place, but it would mean that fewer people would get subsidized insurance, and so it would just take longer it just wouldn't work as quickly as people would like.
We touched on this with both of our phone calls with John and Keith a little bit, but they're currently, Obamacare has no control or reduction in pharmacy costs, prescription costs. Do you expect that will ever be a case? Is that a required part of making Obamacare or any sort of health care less expensive?
Great point. Pharmaceutical industry is a very powerful industry. They gave up billions of dollars to help fund Obamacare, particularly for seniors in the Medicare program and their prescription drug program. But we are the only developed country that does not have some price controls for pharmaceuticals. Our brand name drugs here are much more expensive than in Europe. The pharmaceutical industry says that's the only way that they can continue research and development to bring new blockbuster drugs to the market. But particularly now with these biological drugs, some of the cancer treatments, it's incredibly expensive. I mean, the hepatitis C drug costs $100,000 per regimen. We have 3 to 4 million people in the United States with hepatitis C. That is one of the main challenges going forward in our healthcare system, is how are we going to afford the prescription drugs that the industry churns out to help address some of our medical problems.
And unfortunately, we can't solve that in this hour, but you'll come back another hour and we'll solve that.
Okay, we will.
All right. Carolyn Engelhardt, our guest today. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, everybody.
Obamacare, a topic that we'll have to talk about again in the future. Thank you so much. Les Temps-Perdue, up next.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Brandon Wong and Max Cecilia Struther. Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.